My name is Bracha Rutner. I am the Yoetzet Halacha at the Riverdale Jewish Center. And I also teach at Yeshiva University High School for Girls. I'm head of the Torah Shabbat Peh department. I thought today I would start with a comment by a major commentator, major thinker in our time. I will speak to you in plain, simple English. And that brings us to tonight's word, truthiness. Now, I'm sure some of the word police over at Webster's are going to say, hey, that's not a word. Well, anyone who knows me knows I'm no fan of dictionaries or reference books. I don't trust books. They're all fact, no heart. And that's exactly what's pulling our country apart today. Because face it, folks, we are a divided nation. Not between Democrats and Republicans, or conservatives and liberals, or tops and bottoms. No, we are divided between those who think with their head and those who know with their heart. Truthiness is tearing our country apart. And I don't mean the argument over who came up with the word. It used to be everyone was entitled to their own opinions, but not their own facts. But that's not the case anymore. Facts matter not at all. Perception is everything. It's certainty. People love the president because he's certain of his choices as a leader, even if the facts that back him up don't seem to exist. It's the fact that he's certain that is very appealing to a certain section of the country. I feel a real dichotomy in the American populace. What is important? What you want to be true or what is true? Truthiness is what I say is right and nothing anyone else says could possibly be true. It is not only that I feel it to be true, it's that I feel it to be true. There's not only an emotional quality, but there's also a selfish quality. A very compelling argument or idea that was put forth by Stephen Colbert in his opening segment in the Colbert Report in 2005. Now, even though I said the statement many years ago, I still feel that it is incredibly relevant in our day and age, especially as we enter into a new presidential election. Now, as opposed to an American society, in Judaism, truth is truth and lies are lies. Nothing is relative. There are certain laws that tell us outright that we are not allowed to lie. For example, lo tishaker, do not lie. Lo tia'ed sheker, don't be a false witness. But there are other laws that emphasize the value and importance of honesty in interpersonal relationships. And one of those laws is the laws of Tarat HaMishpacha, the laws of family purity. This is a law that requires that each month when a woman enters into a status of nida, she and her husband separate for a short time until she immerses in the mikvah, and then they reunite. These laws are predicated upon the trust that exists between a husband and a wife. A wife tells her husband when she is in nida, and she also tells him when she has gone to the mikvah. When people lie in any situation, there can be incredible ramifications, unintended consequences, and this is especially true in the area of Tarat HaMishpacha. I will share a story to illustrate the point. A number of years ago, a newly married woman, Kala, that I had taught, called me up and told me that she had gotten into a fight with her husband. And in the midst of their argument, untruthfully, out of anger, she had told him she was in nida. And then, a couple of days later, they made up. So she called me not for halachic advice, but more for relationship advice. How did she tell her husband she had lied? This was a new marriage. How did she repair the damage that she had potentially done? And I actually told her that the situation was much more complex. There may be halachic ramifications in that she may actually have to immerse in the mikvah. She was quite shocked about this. How could it be that if she's not really in nida, the Torah may view her as such? When a woman states that she is in nida, nobody questions her word. This woman was trusted by her husband, and she abused that trust. And therefore, there may be halachic consequences to her actions. But in order to fully understand all the issues at hand, and to tell you the answer, which I will share with you at the end, we have to have background information to really understand how much halachic significance we assign to people's words. How much of what we say has the power to affect others? In Judaism, as in the secular world, when one makes a statement that affects others, they have to bring proof to support their words. For example, if Reuven claims that Shimon owes him money, Reuven must have proof. What is one of the best sources of proof? Witnesses. In American law, witnesses are incredibly important. Legal proceedings, especially trials, depend on witnesses to present factual evidence to the judge or the jury. A witness, according to LegalDictionary.com, my sister, who's a lawyer, told me is a very trustworthy website, is someone who has, who claims to have, or is thought to have knowledge relevant to event of, or other matter of interest. There are two types of witnesses in an American court that are utilized. There's an eyewitness, who is someone who has given testimony under oath in court concerning what they have seen, heard, or otherwise observed. Then, there is an expert witness, sometimes referred to as a character witness, who by reason of education or specialized experience is allowed to testify at a trial, not just about the facts of the case, but also about the professional conclusions he or she may draw from the facts. For example, in a murder trial, a forensics expert may be brought in to provide background information. Now, in an American court, as long as a witness is competent, they may be compelled to testify. If a witness is related to a defendant or even a minor, they may still testify because they are considered a competent witness. The job of the judge, the jury, the lawyers is to determine their credibility. In Judaism, though, witnesses are not just another piece of evidence. They actually present us with the facts of the case. They can put events into context and tell us about people's actions, if they're in response to something, and what was said at the scene of a crime. This is the reason for the serious questioning by the Beit Din of the judges. If you look at the third parak in Masechet Sanhedrin, and you look in the Rambam, you see the list of questions that the Beit Din does. It's called Drisha V'Chakira. It's a very serious investigation to determine if the witnesses are being truthful. Now, Judaism is concerned not just with the competency of a witness, but also with the credibility. And that is why there are so many rules and regulations and qualifications that are necessary for witnesses. We are told, let us now examine some of those rules and regulations regarding a witness in a Jewish court. First, if you look on your source sheet, we are told about the number of witnesses that are required in Beit Din. It says in Dvarim Perek Yotet, Lo yakum eid echad ba'ish l'kol avon u'l'kol chatat. Do not convict a person of a crime based on the testimony of one witness. V'chol chayr asher yechta'a al pi shnei edim or al pi shlosha edim yakum davar. Rather, you need two or three witnesses in order to establish if a crime was committed. Why do we need two or three witnesses? This is in order to ensure the honesty of the witnesses and to corroborate the facts. One person may be trustworthy, but when we have two, it is more reasonable that they are telling the truth. And also, if they are lying, it is easier to catch them. This is emphasized by the Ramban, which is the second source on your source sheet, who says, commentary on this pasuk, Pshuto shel mikra, according to the pshat of the pasuk, Lomar sheyumat hamet al pi shnayim edim kishein sham yoter. Two witnesses can testify about a murder if they are the only witnesses. O al pi shlosha im yimtzum sham shlosha. Or based on the testimony of three witnesses if three are available. Yomar ha-katuv, the pasuk says, Ka'asher hu gad lecha vishamata tidrosh ha-davar heitev al pi kol ha-edim ha-nimtzaim sham. However, when the case is brought to Beit Din, they must thoroughly investigate the situation and question all the witnesses that are present. V'hine im shamanu sha'avar bifnei shlosha, and if we hear that there were three witnesses, nishlach v'avuram v'yavo le-Beit Din v'yidu kulam, then they should come to Beit Din, as many witnesses as possible. V'hu adin l'meya, even if there are 100 witnesses, they should all come to Beit Din. Ki b'shamanu divrei kulam yitbarer ha'emet. Because when we hear the testimony of all of them, the truth will be revealed. V'im lo hayu sham yoter, but if there are no more, there are not a lot of witnesses, o shehalchu lahem ve'inam nimtzaim sham, but we can't find them, v'shnayim dai. Two is the minimum. So we see the number. We want to have honesty, truthfulness, and therefore we need at least two witnesses. But according to the Ramban, the more witnesses that we can find, the better. It's not just the number of witnesses that the Torah values, but also the type of individual who comes to testify. If you look on source 4, the Torah tells us, Al tashet yadacha im rasha liot eid chamas. Do not set your hand with an evil man to be a witness. We learn from here that one who violates a Torah prohibition that warrants the punishment of malkot, karet, mitat beitin, malkot, they cannot testify. There are additional limitations, though. Not just one who violates a Torah iser, but if we look on source 3, in Mishnah Masechet Sanhedrin, Per Gimel Mishnah Aleph, the Mishnah tells us, Zeh posel ediyav shel zeh, v'zeh posel ediyav shel zeh, divrei Rebbe Meir. The litigants have the power to disqualify each other's witnesses. The rabbis ask, when did the litigants have that power? When the litigants can bring proof that the witnesses are either related to each other or related to the litigant, or they're pasul, which we'll expand upon and explain in a moment. But if they are kosher, they cannot be disqualified. So if we look now on source 5, we see what are the psulim. Who are those who are puzzled to testify in Beitin? The elu hein ha-psulim. And we see a list of 4 individuals who are disqualified from being witnesses in court. Ha-misachek b'kubia, one who gambles. Ha-malveh b'ribi, one who lends with interest. Ma-friche yivanim, one who gambles on birds, fighting or steals birds. V'sochrei shvi, one who does business with fruits from the year of Shemitah. So we see here a list of 3 different types of individuals who cannot be witnesses. Those who are related to the litigants or to each other. Those who are over an isur d'oraita. And those who are over any of the isurim or any of the prohibitions listed in Masechet Sanhedrin. And we have to ask ourselves, what is it about these individuals that disqualifies them from being witnesses? So when it comes to family members, there's actually a big debate. Why can't family members testify for each other, or perhaps against each other? So the source itself, the fact that relatives cannot testify for one another, comes from source 6 on your source sheet, Dvarim, Parsha Ki Tetzei, Perek Chavdala, Pasuk Tetzayin. It says in the Pasuk, Lo yimtu avot abanim, ubanim lo yimtu al avot. A father cannot die due to his son, and a son cannot die due to his father. Ish b'chetzo yumato. Rather, a person can die due to their sins. What does this mean? Rashi says, Lo yumatu avot abanim, be'edut banim. A father or a son cannot die based on the testimony of their father or their son. And this is the source that teaches us that relatives cannot testify for one another. But why? So we might, on the one hand, think it's obvious. There's an emotional component. If we look in source 9, going a little out of order here, the Gemara here in Masechet Sanhedrin tells us that someone who is emotionally invested in a court case cannot come, cannot be a dayan, cannot be the judge, and also cannot be the witness. As it says, oheh v'hasoneh, someone who has either loves or hates the other person involved. Okay? So this is a more of a psychological perspective. Someone who truly loves their family member would not want to do anything to harm them. And so they may be willing to lie in order to protect them. In addition, if somebody sees an event and is convinced that it's true, a family member may be willing to lie and say, oh yeah, I saw that event also. But the Rambam tells us it has nothing to do with the emotional component, because the Rambam assumes that a witness will be partial. As it says in source 8, Zeh shepasla edut hakrovim. The fact that the Torah disqualifies the testimony of relatives, Lo mipnei shehein b'chazkat oavin et zetzeh. Not because of the emotional component, not because they love one another. Shaharei eino ma'id lo, lo l'tuvato v'lo l'rato. Because one would be partial when they come to Beitin. Ela gzeirat hakatuv hu. Rather, this is just based on what's written in the Pasuk. It's something that we learn out from the Pasuk, that the Torah tells us is a requirement, but there's no real reason or motivation behind it. I actually found that very interesting coming from the Rambam, who is one who looks at the Chukim, which are the laws without reasons, and actually tries to find reasons for all of them. That here, he says, this is what the Torah says, and there's no real reason behind it. This is just a requirement. That's in regard to relatives. Now, what about the examples in Source 5? The gambler, the one who sells with interest, the one who's involved in bird fighting. So the sources say that they are forbidden from being witnesses because lefi she'eino osek biyishuvo shel olam. They're not concerned with other people. They are only concerned with themselves. And they don't recognize the effort and difficulties that their fellow man may, or woman may encounter, and have no concern if others lose money. And they are prepared to lie at all costs. Certainly wouldn't want someone coming in and testifying for me in that if they fulfilled that requirement. Now, what about people who willfully do sins? We might understand someone who robs, someone who steals, someone who murders. They're not necessarily reliable or honest individuals. But what about one who's mechalel Shabbat, who violates Shabbat? Why does that affect their ability to testify? So Rabbi Forst, in his book, Halachot of Nida, provides us with an explanation. He says, and I quote, "Relying upon another Jew's testimony pertaining to matters of halacha is actually not an issue of credibility or trust at all. It is a unique manner in which halacha functions. I may lend a large sum of money to someone whom I trust. I may purchase a used car from a credible dealer. My decision is based upon whether or not I feel comfortable entrusting this person with my money. It is my money, and I may risk losing it as I choose. A Torah prohibition, however, is not mine. I cannot entrust an issue regarding a Torah iser to one who is not acceptable according to the standards of the Torah itself." So according to this, Edut is a halachic responsibility. And while one may be a trustworthy individual in general, this obligation of testifying requires specific prerequisites. One of those, that the individual follows the laws of the Torah. So we see from here different types of disqualifications for a witness. Or, we can look at it from the other perspective, what exactly is required when one comes to testify in Beit Din? We need a minimum of 2 witnesses. We need an honest individual. We need one who is committed to the Torah, and one who is not related to anybody else in the court case. But the Rambam comes along and tells us of another disqualification, that based upon gender. If you look at Source 10, the Rambam tells us, Nashim psulot le'edut min ha-Torah. Women are disqualified from being witnesses according to the Torah. Shenemar, as it says, the pasuk we saw, al pishnayim edim, based on the testimony of 2 witnesses, lashon zachar velo lashon nekeva. The pasuk is written in the language, in the male and masculine, not in the feminine. So the Kesef Mishnah, commentator on the Rambam, in Source 11, is very surprised at the Rambam. And he says, "Beperek Shvuat Ha'edu, in Masechet Sanhedrin Daf Lamed, Perek Shvuat Ha'edu, it says, Amrinan, Vamdu Shnei Ha'anashim. It quotes us a pasuk that testimony has to be based on the, you have to bring 2 men, Be'edim, to be witnesses. Hakatuv Medaber, Klomar Lelamed She'ein Edu Panashim. The source is coming to teach us that women cannot be witnesses. Ubisifrei, and in the Sifrei, Vamdu Shnei Ha'anashim. The fact that it says 2 men, nomar kan shnai, it says there too, v'nemar ve'edut al pishnai medim, and when we talk about edut, it mentions 2 edim. Makan anashim, just as in one situation, we require the testimony of men. Aflahalan anashim, we require the testimony of men for all edut. Mikan, from here, she'in ha'ishak she'ra leha'i. This is a better source, he says. I don't understand why Rabbeinu, the Rambam, didn't use this source. The source that he brought that the Torah that Al Pi Shnayim Medim is written b'lashon zachar doesn't feel comfortable, the Kesef Mishnah says. Sharei kol ha-Torah b'lashon zachar ne'emra. Because the whole Torah is written b'lashon zachar. Does that mean all women are excluded from every single mitzvah? So we know that even though the Kesef Mishnah has difficulty with the Rambam's source, he does not have difficulty with the Rambam's halacha. So it seems whatever the source is, Al Pi Shnayim Edim, or the connection, the juxtaposition of the different psukim that the Kesef Mishnah uses as his source, women cannot be witnesses in court. And we have to ask ourselves, why? There are lots and lots of different reasons that are provided to us as to why a woman cannot be a witness. So, if we look in source 12, we see the Tosfot. Tosfot here in Masechet Zvachim says, V'hakshar harav Rav Chaim, right? Rav Chaim asks the question, D'beperk ha'chovel and Baba Kama, Matzrich trei krai gabe edut, chad l'mu'utei nashim, v'chad l'mu'utei avadim. He wants to know, why do we need two separate sources to disqualify a servant from being an eved, from being a witness, and a woman from being a witness? We know often nashim, avadim, and ketanim are put together in terms of their qualifications or disqualifications. But when it comes to edut, we have two separate psukim. So, the Baalei Tosfot want to know why. And they say, v'yesh lamar, the answer is, we can learn them out when it comes to mitzvot, the rules of avadim and nashim, from the same source. But when it comes to testimony, you can't learn them out from the same sources. Because testimony in this situation is not because of their trustworthiness. Because Moshe and Aaron couldn't come and testify, lo mishum de lo mahamne, not because they weren't believed. Hilkach hecha de gali gali. That's why we need two different sources. So it seems from the Tosfot that there's no real reason why why women are disqualified. Rather, it's a gzeirat hakatuv, because the Torah says so. But there are other ideas that are provided for us, not just because the Torah said so. One of those is in source 13. The Gemara Masechet Shavuot says, V'chi teima isha lav orcha. It's not the way of women to testify. Mishim kol kvoda bat melech panima. Because of the concept of kol kvoda bat melech panima, that a woman needs to be a modest individual. We know, and I'll explain exactly what that means. We know that when an individual witnesses an event, they can be subpoenaed, American law, Jewish law, they can be forced and compelled to come to court. The Torah feels that this is not appropriate to compel a woman to come to court. If she chooses, she can go out in public, but the Beit Din cannot force her. And so, since the rules are that any witness who has witnessed a crime must be compelled, or can be compelled, to come to court. Therefore, this is not appropriate, an appropriate requirement of women. There's another idea that's presented, which has to do with the serious questioning that is done by the Beit Din. If we look in Masechet Shavuot, or Masechet Sanhedrin, the question is asked, Ketzad me'ayim et ha'edim? How do we scare the witnesses? What does this mean? Beit Din wants to ensure that the witnesses are telling the truth. And so, when two witnesses come to court, or however many witnesses end up coming, they put them in separate rooms. The entire Beit Din comes, and if it's a murder case, it could be up to 72 dayanim, and they ask very serious questions of the edim. A little bit scary. Actually quite scary, and the Mishnah and the Gemara address that. Why would anybody want to undergo this? But they emphasize that it's the responsibility of an individual who has seen an event to come to Beit Din. But the sense in the Gemara is that this is not an appropriate experience for a woman. It's below her kavod, and she should not undergo this kind of questioning. But what I will tell you is that in reality, women were and are used in Beit Din. And this is based in certain circumstances. This is based on the words of the Ramah in source 14, who says, Aval yesh omrim, there are those who say, detakanat kadmonim hu, that there was an early decree, debemakom she'ein anashim regilim liyo, that in a situation where men usually are not, kigon bebayit shel nashim, or bishar dvar akrai she'isha regila velo anashim. For example, in a house of women, as rat nashim, or in a happenstance circumstances where there are no men, or men are not usually around, a woman can come and testify. There are different people who dispute this. Maybe we really rescinded this decree, this takanat kadmonim. There are those who argue in the Gemara that perhaps a woman would actually make a better witness because she is more attuned to details. And in reality, women are, when there are no other witnesses, relied upon in certain circumstances. But we see that in general, under normal circumstances, a woman is not used or utilized as a witness. But there is an area of halacha where we do rely upon a woman to testify about her situation, and that is with regard to Taharat HaMishpacha. Women are believed by their husbands to say that they have counted and that they have gone to the mikvah. And the question is why? By determining their status, women are making statements that affect others, namely their husbands, and in a very serious way. Because if a couple is together when it is forbidden, they are both liable for the punishment of kari, a serious punishment which, while we don't really understand it, may result in their early deaths and being cut off from the rest of Bnei Yisrael. A woman, through her statements, has the power to saddle her husband with a serious punishment that is irreversible, and yet we rely upon her. But we don't rely upon her to come to court to make someone pay money, which can always be returned. So the question is, what is the difference between Taharat HaMishpacha, which can be viewed as a form of testimony, and coming to court? Why is it different? So if we look at the Gemara in Ketubot, which is source number 15, we are told why women are relied upon in the area of Taharat HaMishpacha. Damar Rabbi Chinana Bar Kahana Amar Shmuel. Rabbi Chinana Bar Kahana says in the name of Shmuel, Minayin l'nida shesoferet la'atzma. Where do we learn out that a woman who is a nida counts for herself and she does not have to provide testimony? Shene'emar, as it says in Vayikra, V'safra la shivat yamin. The pasuk says she counts for herself for 7 days. La, latzma. The word la is extra. It could have simply just said V'safra shivat yamin. But the fact that it adds the word in la, the Torah teaches us that we rely upon her. So and this is considered a gzeret hakatuv, because the Torah says, just as there was a gzeret hakatuv that disqualified her from being a witness in Beitin, there is a gzeret hakatuv that qualifies her to be a witness in the area of Taharat HaMishpacha. But I think there's a little bit more going on here than just a gzeret hakatuv. First of all, from a practical perspective, if a woman had to bring witnesses and testimony every single time that she was in Nida, I think the halakha would be untenable. People would not be able to follow it properly. But in addition, Rabbi Forst, in his book Hilchot Nida, says, the halakhot of Nida are predicated upon mutual trust between man and wife. A wife relies upon her husband in matters of halakha. Similarly, a husband relies upon his wife to inform him of any change in her Nida status. Indeed, the concept of trust, i.e. that one Jew may rely upon another in most prohibitions, is derived from the trust the Torah accords to a woman. The trust that exists between a husband and a wife is an incredibly important component of marriage. And I think that Taharat HaMishpacha is one of those laws that emphasizes that and teaches us. But these rules that a woman can be relied upon, one witness, in this specific area is not limited just to Taharat HaMishpacha. It actually teaches us about the laws in a whole set of other halachot. We know that there are certain things that are always forbidden. Robbery, murder, lying. But there are other things that under certain circumstances can be okay, and under certain other circumstances can't be. Taharat HaMishpacha, those are called Hilchot Isser V'Heter. Taharat HaMishpacha, sometimes a couple can be together, sometimes they can't. Kashrut. Sometimes things are okay, and sometimes they're not. And if you look in source 16, The Rush teaches us, V'had eid echad ne'eman b'isurin, the fact that one aid can be relied upon for isurin, hani mili lismoch alav lahatir, and we can rely upon them to tell us that something that might be usur is actually mutter, d'garminan min v'safrala. We learn this out from the laws of Tarat HaMishpacha. We know that we eat in each other's homes. We rely upon each other's kashrut. And yet, even a minor can be trusted to determine the status of food. So we see that two witnesses are required for cases that are brought to Beit Din about things that are absolute, like lying and stealing, murder, etc. But when it comes to Isser V'Heter, we can rely upon one witness, even a woman. Now, we rely upon the woman to declare her status, but in addition, she can also be relied upon to help her friends. There's a very famous story in the Gemara of a woman named Yalta. She was the wife of Rav Nachman bar Yaakov, a prominent rabbi in the 4th century. In this story in the Gemara, she takes her bedikah cloth to Rabbi bar Barchana, who tells her it's a problem, and therefore she's Tmei'ah. She then takes the same bedikah cloth to Rav Yitzchak, the son of Rav Yehuda, who tells her that it is okay. This story is very problematic because we know that once we ask the psak from one rabbi, we're not supposed to then go ahead and ask the psak from another. And the question is, why did Yalta do this? So there are two different endings to the story, one vindicating her and one saying that she did the wrong thing. However, what many say, the ending that vindicates her, says that normally, Rabbi Bar Barchana says that this color is okay, but he had a problem with his eyes and therefore told her that the color was not okay. If you look at the Shach in source 28, he learns out from this, Mashma de'im omer adam zeh oketem zeh tiher li hachacham ne'emenet. If she says, well, under most circumstances, the rabbi would tell me this is okay, then we can rely upon her in a questionable situation. There is also a case that the Shulchan Aruch brings of a blind woman who wants to keep the laws of Tarat HaMishpacha. This is a situation where a woman cannot check to see if things are okay or if things are not okay. So if you look here in the Shulchan Aruch, he says, Hasuma bodeket atzma, a blind woman can, source 29, can check for herself, umare lechaverta, and she can show her friend, and we can rely upon her friend in that situation. So we see here that a woman can be relied upon to determine her own status, and in addition to help out her friend. But the question is, how far does this trust extend? I want to look at some sources that discuss the reliance that a husband and a wife have upon each other and the effects that it may have on the psychological well-being of their relationship. The Torah tells us, now going back to source number 17, Kisha omer lo tavalti ne'emenet. When a woman says she has gone to the mikvah, her husband trusts her. And in my experience, teaching men this can sometimes be extremely helpful. I have worked with couples who have had situations where the husband has had difficulty trusting his wife. He questions her, he asks her what's going on. Some of this is due to the nervousness. He may be taught the value and the importance of Tarat HaMishpacha, and not necessarily the value and importance of trusting his wife, which is something that should come naturally. But when it comes to this area of halakha, because it is so serious, and while I don't like to emphasize punishments, it's there in the back of our minds, men sometimes are nervous, and so they question their wives. Something else that can inhibit trust is obsessive-compulsive disorder. Psychologists that I have worked with have told me that obsessive-compulsive disorder often expresses itself in two areas, cleaning rituals and religious rituals. That's why sometimes you will see men sitting in shul going like this with their tefillin, or women also shuckling very hard when they daven, or people being very strict on Pesach. But it can show and express itself in the area of Tarat HaMishpacha also. I've worked with couples where husbands will go through the garbage or through the laundry sometimes to go ahead and see what's going on to make sure that the wife is okay. But sometimes that inability to trust doesn't rely on the husband, or doesn't lie with the husband, it actually lies with the wife. That same idea of obsessive compulsive disorder can also affect a woman. I've worked with a large number of women who've had, who in their normal lives may not express any form of OCD, but sometimes when it comes to Nida, they do. Preparing for the mikvah, coming home from the mikvah, doing all the checks that they need to do. I remember the first woman that I worked with, she would bring me bags and bags every month of Bdika cloths. And it got to a point where I really knew this was outside of the realm of my expertise. And so I suggested, I thought subtly, that she see a therapist, perhaps she needed help. She never called me again. So I tried to figure out ways in the future to suggest things to people in a different way, and I have worked with people who have ended up seeing therapists for this, or sometimes just had more open conversations. But we know that when a woman doesn't trust herself in the area of Taharat HaShmacha, be it for a psychological reason, be it just because she's nervous, this can have detrimental effects on the marital relationship. Sometimes she can be so nervous, and I've seen this, that Taharat HaMishpacha becomes this terrifying experience for her. Or other times, not as extreme, women will delay going to the mikvah and therefore potentially affect their ability to get pregnant or potentially affect the relationship. Just one extra day can sometimes cause extra tension in the marriage. And so it is so important, and when I know when I teach my kala classes, that I talk about this idea of ne'manut ha'isha, the fact that a woman is trusted and relied upon by halacha, and therefore she should trust and rely upon herself, and certainly her husband should never question her. Now, the sources go on to talk about different ways that a woman can declare herself to be in nida, and what happens when she takes advantage of that situation. So if we look at source number 18, the Torah says, "V'imhuchzaka nida b'shchunoteha." If a woman somehow establishes in public that she is in nida, "Kigon shira'uha loveshet bigadim hamiyuchadim la b'yemei nidata." For example, she wears her nida clothes, "Chashiva kevadai tme'a." She is considered as if she is certainly in nida. Some of us may look at this and wonder, what does that mean, nida clothes? So we know that the Torah tells us that there are two reasons for nida practice. Nowadays, we keep nida because it is listed in Vayikra amongst the rules, prohibitions of arayot, of forbidden relationships. And it says that a husband and a wife cannot be intimate when she is in nida. That is why we keep Taharat HaMishpacha today. But we know, we just read it. We know that in Vayikra, we are also told about the laws of Tuma and Tahara, that when one is Tameh, they cannot go to the Beit HaMikdash. And what are the different types of Tuma and Tahara? One of them is coming in contact with a dead body. One is coming in contact with a dead bug. One is coming in contact with a man who has a seminal emission, Poletet Shechvatzera, and a woman who is in Nida. And it was very important in the times of the Beit HaMikdash that people knew what everybody's status was. Because it wasn't just coming in contact with a woman in Nida that would now require someone to be Tame and go to the mikvah in order for them to be able to go to the Beit HaMikdash. In fact, any surface that she came in contact, a movable object, certainly certain requirements, if she came in contact with certain objects and then someone else touched them, they also may have been Tame and had to go to the mikvah. And so it was very important, I think, a world that we cannot relate to, that everybody knew what everybody's status was. And so women, the Gemara talks about certain clothes that women used to wear that would declare to the world that they were in Nida. Nowadays, we don't have that. Although some people do have the practice individually, most people don't, between a husband and a wife, that there might be certain clothes that she'll wear when she's in Nida. The sources do talk about that. But there are other ways that she can declare that she's in Nida. If we look at source 19, the Badei HaShulchan says, "K'hayom sh'rov ha'nashim lo nehagu le'yached b'yigadim l'mein nidatan." Nowadays, we don't have that practice that people wear specific nida clothes. "Lo shayach sh'titchazek b'nidut ayadei b'gdeha." That declaration or that idea of the Torah that a woman could declare her nida status through her clothes is really not relevant. "Aval efshar sh'titchazek sh'hit me'ad b'drachim acharim." But there are other ways that she can declare her status. "V'afil lo asa shum pu'ula." She doesn't even have to do an action. אלא שאמרה לפני השכנות בסיפורי דברים המוכיח לפניהם שהיא טמאה. She insinuates in certain ways by comments that she makes or things that she says that she is טמאה, that she's in nida, ונתחזק כן בליבן. And now it is established in their heart that she is in nida. Or if we look in the Darchei Tara, which was written by Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, he says, שמסר לה חפץ והיא לא קיבלה מידו. Her husband passes her something and she doesn't accept it. או שהרחיקה את המיטות, or she separates the beds, או שסימנה לו באיזה סימן אחר המוסקים ביניהם שהיא נידה. Or she sends him some other signal that is clear to him that she's in nida. So there are these different ways that she can declare herself in nida. Publicly, privately, different things that she can do through her words, through her actions, through insinuations to declare her nida status. But what happens if she contradicts herself? She seems to act one way in public and then another way in private, or says one thing in public and does another thing in private. What happens then? So if we look in source 21, the Shulchan Aruch says, Amra la ba'ala, a woman says, Tmei'a ani. She says to her husband, I'm tmei'a, I'm in nida. V'achar kach amra tahorani. Afterwards she says tahorani, Eina ne'emenet. If she contradicts herself, then she loses that trustworthiness. We have to ask ourselves, under what circumstances? So we're given a whole bunch of different rules and regulations about that. The Shach says, under what circumstances is she not believed? V'derech schok amarti lecha tchila eina ne'emenet. If she was just joking, she was flippant about it. Oh, I'm in nida, I'm not in nida. Under those circumstances, she may lose her trustworthiness and her reliance. But there are other instances where she contradicts herself, where she can be believed. If you look in Source 23, the Torah says, Amra la ba'ala tmeani, v'achar kach amra tohora'ani, ina ne'emenet. So she might not be believed if she contradicts herself. However, v'im no tenet amakla ledvareha. If she gives an amatla for her words, she'amra lo kein tchila mipnei shelo haya bakoach, she says, oh, I didn't have the strength before, o davar ki yotze baze, or for other some other reason, ne'emenet, she is believed. So what is an amatla? Rashi says, mashal v'tam lama amra tchila. It's an excuse. It is a halachic excuse for our actions. What are types of halachic excuses? So the Shach says, Ein ba koach. I didn't have strength and that's why to be with you, that's why I told you that. Big question mark exactly what that is. What I have found are other types of halachic excuses. If we look also in the Shach, in Source 25, he says, She'omra svora hayiti liop nida. I thought I was in nida. Aval achshav badakti atzmi, but now I checked myself. Umatzati shemachmat maka uchabura ba'ilai hadam ikiyotze bezen emenet. There's a medical issue. She was mistaken. She thought she was in nida. She went to a rav, she went to a doctor. She found out that she actually was not in nida. In those circumstances, she is certainly trustworthy because this was not something that she intended. She did not think when she made that statement that she was telling a lie, but it ended up that she was mistaken. And I'll tell you a story. A woman once called me who was 8 weeks pregnant. And she had been in nida the entire time. She had what we call prolonged implantation bleeding. Women will sometimes, when the embryo implants in the uterus, experience bleeding. And she had been bleeding for 8 weeks. And she had assumed the entire time that she was in nida. But she was getting extremely frustrated. And finally she decided, you know what, I'm going to pick up the phone and I'm going to make that phone call and see what's going on. After consulting with her doctor and consulting with her rav, we discovered that she had been mistaken. And so she cried to me on the phone. I haven't even given my husband a hug, she told me, since I told him that I was pregnant. And then she became angry with herself. Why didn't I pick up the phone? Why didn't I make a phone call? I said, you didn't know. But that is a classic example of an amakla. Someone who thinks they are in nida because of circumstances, perhaps lack of knowledge of medical information, halachic information, and then finds out later that they were mistaken. And it doesn't necessarily matter how long. This woman thought she was in nida for an extended period of time. But, and the Rama actually adds that there, if a woman and her husband are in a fight, and she tells him that she's in nida, she may be believed. I don't think the Rama is condoning telling a husband that a woman is in nida. And I don't think that this is something that we should ever use against our spouses, or that a woman should ever use against her spouse. Nida is something that is very serious, and there's a lot of trust that goes on here. And I know as a child, my mother always taught me, put yourself in other people's shoes. Treat other people the way that you would want to be treated. And I can't imagine how a woman would feel if her husband came over to her and said, for whatever reason, I can't be with you tonight, and uses halacha against her. And I don't think that a woman should ever use halacha in the midst of a fight. However, the Rama says under certain circumstances, she would not necessarily be in nida. But there are limitations to this amatla. There are times when it won't work. We saw for the shach, a woman is joking. It doesn't work. But it also does not work when a woman makes public statements about her being in nida. If we look at source 26, it says, "Huchzaka nida b'shkinoteha." If a woman establishes her actions, her words, her clothes, whatever way that she's in nida in public, v'acharkach, and afterwards, "Omer tahora ani," she says, "I am tahora." Afilo notenet amatla l'dvareha. She even gives a halachic excuse for her words. Shomeret lo lavashti begadim elu. I only wore those clothes. Ela shelo tadridenu, because I was busy and I didn't have time to change, or I wasn't healthy. Kilo hayiti bria. Inan emene. In that circumstance, she's not believed. So the question is why? Why? What's unique about huchzaka nida b'shkinoteha? So the Torah tells us in source 27, deshani huchzaka nida b'shkinoteha. Establishing nida in public is different than when it's established in private. Delav kule ama yadam in hamatla. Because everyone else is not going to find out about this halachic excuse. V'im kein ama samcha shehechzika atzma neged kule ama. And therefore now, what is she going to do in public? Masha ein kein belmeret laba'alat me'ani afshar shesamcha atzma shachar kach tomra lo et hamatla. When it's different when she tells her husband in private. Because perhaps she will be able to tell him the amatla after. So it seems that when one declares that they are nida in public, it's different when they make the declaration in private. And I think it's for the following reason. Imagine if there's a public figure, somebody that we rely upon for halacha, and they tell us, a woman tells us she's in nida, lets everybody know, and then she acts a certain way which seems to perhaps go against the halacha. People may look at her and learn from her actions and think that certain things are acceptable, which might not be. So those are the limitations. Now I want to tell you a story, which I thought was interesting, related to this. There's a story about a woman who is having difficulty. The Tor, the Taz, and the Shach, which are commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, share the story with us. They tell us that there's a woman who is having difficulty keeping her pregnancies. She has several miscarriages, and she's convinced it's because of the ayin hara. So she thinks that if she acts in public as if she's in nida, this will ward off the ayin hara, and she'll be able to carry her pregnancy to term. Now the Taz and the Shach have two different endings. One ending is that her husband knew her plans in the beginning, so when she acted in nida in public, and then when she went home, he knew, and she acted differently, he knew originally what her plan was. But the other ending of the story is that she didn't share with him what she was going to do. And in that instance, it's kind of surprising because we just said that if a woman acts one way in public and then another way in private, she's not necessarily believed to change her status. But in this situation, because of the extenuating circumstances, she is believed. So now that we've seen all of these details, I'll share with you the ending of the story. The end of the story went as follows. So I went to my rabbi. I was actually in the midst of training to be a yoetzet when this woman had called me. And I went to the rabbi, and he happened to be in consultation at that point with another rabbi. And they went back and forth. Do we rely on the Rama and tell the woman who initially had told her husband she was in nida in the midst of a fight, and say it's okay, even though she wasn't honest? Or do we rely on the Shach, who says, oh, derech tzchok, if a woman tells it flippantly, then she's not believed? And I have to tell you, they were back and forth for about a half an hour. And ultimately, they decided to rely upon the Rama, but they told me to have a very serious conversation with her after about the value of truth and honesty. And I went back and I told her, talked to her husband, and thank God, this was 9 years ago, they're still happily married. So I hope today that we've learned the importance of trust and honesty, especially in interpersonal relationships. Trust and honesty are not relative. Not because I believe something to be true is it true, but rather based on the facts. And that we see the incredible value of being honest and not taking advantage of that honesty and the potential effects that it might have upon us, others, and our relationships with them. Thank you very much.